Okay, here we go. We are recording. Today is Monday, July 10th, 2017, and this is Angela Guzman interviewing Sonia Pressman Fuentes for the Virginia Foremothers Oral History Project, which is an archival project of the Virginia chapter of the National Organization for Women, more commonly known as NOW. So, Sonia, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us here today. I'm sorry we're not in person, but I think we can make this work. I'm excited to chat with you and learn more about your contributions to the women's movement. So I'd like, if this works for you, I'd like to start at the beginning of your story. You have a very unique story. You were a refugee. You immigrated to the United States when you were a small child with your family escaping Nazi Germany. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and anything that you might remember of that early childhood before you left and what that journey was like for you.
Well, first of all, I don't have any memory before I was six when we were already in the United States and I was going to kindergarten. But while I don't have any memory, I know everything from what my parents and brother told me. But I don't have any independent memory before I was 6 years old, which would have been in 1934.
Okay.
But you need to ask me anything specific so I can respond to you.
Sure, sure. Well, I know in coming here, I also thought it was interesting that it was your brother that sort of prompted that journey initially, and then he moved first to Belgium, and then you followed, correct?
Right. And we weren't really following him. We didn't plan to leave Germany. My brother was very prescient and saw immediately in 1932 the threat that, I think it was 32, might have been 33, the threat that Hitler posed to the Jews, mm-hmm. and wanted my parents to leave, but my father refused. So my brother went by himself to Antwerp, Belgium, because we had some cousins there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always angry at myself because I didn't ask my father what made him change his mind. But they wanted my brother to come back to Germany. They needed him in the business, and they wanted him back to be with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father changed his mind and sat down with a small group of Nazis and gave them our the store, which we were renting, and our apartment building where we were living, and an apartment building of about 40 apartments and four stores that my father had bought not too long before for investment. And the Nazis gave us a fraction of their value, but permitted us to leave.
Mm-hmm. And you ultimately came to the United States on passports from your Polish passports.
Right.
And ended up in New York. Can you talk a little bit of what you remember about ending up in New York from your earlier childhood days?
Well, don't remember too much. There isn't too much to tell. We came to New York City and we rented an apartment in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, his business was men's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he opened up a men's clothing store in the Bronx with an American partner.
Okay.
And then one summer we went for a couple of weeks to the Catskill Mountains of New York on vacation. When we came back, my father announced that we'd be moving to the Catskills.
Uh-huh.
By that time, I think he wasn't happy doing business in New York. It was very different from the style of business, from the lifestyle in Berlin. In Berlin, he used to close the store and go home for lunch. And it was a more leisurely pace of life than he found in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't agree with some things with his partner. And so he just announced to the family that we're moving to the Catskills, and we moved there in 1936.
Okay. And I'd like to also spend a little time talking about your education, because you were certainly one who excelled for every period of your education, from your high school graduation as valedictorian, to Phi Beta Kappa at Cornell, to your law studies at the University of Miami, where you graduated first in your class there as well. So I think, you know, I think it's fair to say you've put a high premium on excelling in education, and would you contribute any of that to your experience from coming from Nazi Germany?
No, I didn't necessarily put a high premium on education. I just went to school and the best that I could. I got no guidance from my family because they were refugees as I was and knew nothing about America or education, and nor did I. I enjoyed school, but I didn't, as you say, put any premium on excelling or anything like that. I just...
You were just a natural.
If an exam came, I took it, and if a test came, I took it, and I just did the work, and I ended up that way, but it wasn't my goal.
Wow, I'm actually surprised to hear that, but good for you. So, transitioning a bit towards the more specifics of why we're here today and talking about your contributions to the women's movement, can you help? I know you took some time in other places to elaborate on your definitions of the second wave of feminism. I feel like when we talk about the women's movement, the waves can kind of be a little bit distracting and confusing for people. So, as we move into that part of the conversation, can you help set the stage for what exactly and how exactly we should define the second wave, so to speak, of which you are a part?
Well, I'm not the final arbiter on those definitions, but I'll tell you how I understand it.
Okay.
And I agree with you totally that people are not sure what periods of time those titles referred to.
Yeah.
I call the first wave the period of time that started about in 1848, when there was the first women's rights conference in Seneca Falls, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And the women there came up with a statement of sentiments, I think they called it, with their demands. And there wasn't too much that happened after that first wave beginning in 1848, because not too long after that, the Civil War came. And it was the sentiment that the women's rights movement needed to take a back seat, and that the country wasn't going to focus on that because we were busy fighting the Civil War. So it was the first demand by women for their rights, but not too much came of it, other than that women were demanding their rights. Now, there was also, I think there was a prior conference, actually, in Worcester, Massachusetts. I don't know whether it was prior or shortly thereafter, but Worcester claims that the Seneca Falls Conference wasn't really a national conference, as most of the attendees were from that area. And I think Worcester claimed that maybe its conference was later, but that its conference was the first national one. But nobody knows about that conference. Few people know about it. Mm-hmm. And the one that's the big time in history is the 1848 conference. So then there wasn't too much that happened after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the fight for suffrage, which I don't think has a name as a wave, but that fight took about 72 years, and it was ultimately successful, and we got the vote after 72 years of fighting for it with the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which became effective in 1920. Then I used to say in my speeches that not too much happened from the time we got the vote until the early and mid-1960s, but I've since read a book, and I stand a little bit corrected. There were women and women's groups that continued to fight for women's rights after we got the vote and before the second wave, but they were small groups, small numbers of women, and nothing really came as a result of their efforts. But there were women fighting during all that time.
Okay.
Well, then in the early, mid-early 60s, a number of things happened, and I discussed this in speeches that I give. Mm-hmm. But the president created, I think it was President Kennedy, created the a Women's Commission, a President's Commission on the Status of Women, mm-hmm. and they issued a report, I think, and it came out in 1963, but I could be wrong, could have been 61. They came out with a report called American Women, setting forth a list of things that needed to be done for women. And then in 1963, the Equal Pay Act was passed to become effective in 1964, and it required equal pay for equal or substantially equal work. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, 1964, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed to become effective July 2nd, 1965. And it required non-discrimination in all terms and conditions of employment based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. And later on, they also got jurisdiction over age discrimination and discrimination with other laws based on a physical or mental handicap. But the big thing was that Title VII required equality, and the big thing for us was the Title VII required equality with regard to sex mm-hmm. in employment. Right. And that became effective July 2nd, 65. And then for the first year or so, the agency charged with administering that new law was the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And for a number of reasons, for the first year or so of that act, it really wasn't doing much about women's rights. Mm-hmm. And that led to the formation of the National Organization for Women, or NOW, one of whose main reason it was formed was to get the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, mm-hmm. to enforce the gender discrimination prohibitions of Title VII. And when NOW was formed, which was at two meetings in June and October of 1966, mm-hmm. that was the start of the second wave.
Okay. And I'd like to take a few steps back from where you talked us up through, just to help folks understand your contributions to the story more specifically. And, for instance, when you ended up at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and I can only imagine what this must have felt like for you, a brand new agency that you're having to navigate as the first woman in your role, reporting to a man who was tasked more specifically with the civil rights component of it, I would think.
Well, the women's rights is also civil rights.
Well, I stand corrected. But I would say, from what I've seen, is you had to really push the gender fight to the surface because people were more focused on the racial component, if that is more of a clear characterization.
That is absolutely right. Yeah. And the reason is that Title VII was passed in response to the civil rights movement. What happened, that was the reason for the passage of the act. So in the early year or so, there were about 100 permanent employees at the EEOC. And they were there because of racial discrimination in this country. But what happened was that towards the latter stages of debate in Congress on the act, Congressman Howard Smith, the segregationist from Virginia, got up and proposed an amendment. At that time, the act did not include a prohibition against gender discrimination. And he got up and proposed that the act be amended to include a prohibition against sex discrimination. Now, his motives may have been mixed, and different writers have written their views of this, but as to why he did this, but it is not clear. He could have had various motivations. First of all, he was close to Alice Paul, mm-hmm. who was the founder of the National Woman's Party, and he and she didn't want blacks under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to get rights over white women. So one of his reasons for proposing the amendment may have been so that women would also get rights in Title VII, not just blacks. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he was a segregationist who was opposed to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, opposed to Title VII. He voted against them, and he may have proposed that amendment thinking it would cause so much havoc that it would delay the passage of the act or keep it from being passed altogether.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit more then about the types of questions you had to grapple with at the EEOC, the types of things that were decided on your watch, and what sorts of issues that particularly pertained to women.
Well, we were immediately faced, I'm going to speak about women, with a host of issues, because first of all, as I told you, the prohibition against sex discrimination came in as a surprise, although I must say that Congresswoman Martha Griffiths, who was an outstanding fighter for women in the Congress and later became Lieutenant Governor of Michigan, and whom I had the privilege of knowing, told me once that if Howard Smith hadn't proposed a prohibition against sex discrimination in Title VII, she would have done so. Mm-hmm. So we'll never know, but she certainly told me that, so it would have come into the act. But in any event, the country was not prepared for a law prohibiting gender discrimination in employment, because there wasn't a movement, as I mentioned to you, mm-hmm. before the passage of Title VII for women, as there was the movement for blacks. Mm-hmm. And people had not debated these issues. So one of the problems, and the biggie was, that the prohibition against discrimination based on race or color did not present many difficult legal questions at the outset. There were legal issues later on dealing with seniority and other things, but mostly the prohibition against discrimination based on race or color was pretty clear-cut. Mm-hmm. But the prohibition against gender discrimination raised a host of issues that people hadn't thought of. And by the way, I want to mention mm-hmm. that there were a couple, and maybe more, there were prominent women who opposed the addition of sex to Title VII, and the two that come to mind, whom I knew and certainly knew of, they were very prominent women, were Esther Peterson, mm-hmm. who had a high position in the Department of Labor, and Mary Kaiserling, who was head of the Women's Bureau in the Department of Labor. And I was opposed to that position when I learned about it, although I wasn't involved before the act was passed. But they felt that there should be a separate act dealing with sex discrimination, and they did not want it to be part of Title VII. Hmm. So here are some of the issues we had to deal with. First of all, we immediately got complaints from flight cabin attendants, who in those days were called stewardesses and pursers. They had previously already filed complaints with the New York State Commission on Human Rights. And when we opened for business, they filed complaints with us because the hiring of men or women as flight attendants had a mixed history, in that there were times when the American Airlines hired only women. There were times when they hired only men for that position. When Title VII became effective in 1965, American Airlines were hiring only women for domestic flights and only men or international flights. And they got paid more for the international flights. And not only did they hire only women for domestic flights, but they then had all kinds of rules for them. They had to be a certain height and a certain weight. But more importantly, they grounded them or terminated them when they got married or became 32 or 35. And this was advantageous for the airlines because they didn't have to keep promoting women and paying them more money as they progressed in their jobs, because if they got married or were 32 or 35, they were grounded or terminated. So this was a very big issue in the early days. And the airlines in the beginning, they took one position. They said, well, the female flight attendants are there to attract male passengers. And they got some bad publicity for that, and they dropped it. And they also took the position that since they are hiring only women, Title VII doesn't apply, because Title VII prohibits discrimination. But if you're only hiring members of one gender, Title VII doesn't come into play. So the commission had a very tough time with this issue and had a sets of hearings, but eventually came out with the position that it was a violation of Title VII to hire only women as flight cabin attendants in the United States flights, and to apply certain conditions and rules to their employment which were not similarly applied to the men who were pursers. Another big issue was state protective legislation. In the past, due to sweatshop conditions in certain industries, labor unions and other people fighting for the rights of workers wanted to get protective legislation passed for employees so that they shouldn't be taken advantage of as they were in sweatshops. But they feared that they would not be successful in getting such legislation passed for men and women. So they got such legislation passed for women only. And this was called state protective legislation. And it provided that wherever states had such laws, that the women had to have lunch breaks and rest breaks, they had to have seats or benches, they couldn't work at night, they couldn't lift more than, I forget whether it was 5 pounds or 15 pounds. And those laws were meant to protect women in the times when they were passed. But by the time the 1960s came around, those laws were keeping women from getting good-paying jobs. And the prohibitions of the state protective laws were keeping women from getting jobs and being promoted rather than protecting them. So the question arose, did Title VII supersede the state protective legislation? Because the general legal principle is that if you have a federal law on the same subject as a state law and they're in conflict, the state law falls, mm-hmm. and the federal law supersedes it. Mm-hmm. So that was a legal question, and the commission eventually ruled, and the courts affirmed it, that Title VII superseded conflicting state protective laws. Now, there were some laws that provided benefits for women, such as seating or rest periods. And the commission held that where protective legislation provided benefits for women, an employer would have to provide the same benefits to men. But if the law prohibited women from certain jobs and activities, those laws fell, because they were superseded by Title VII. Another question we had to deal with was employers would say, well, I'm perfectly happy to hire women as lawyers or as policemen or whatever, but the clients or the community won't come to my business if I have a woman lawyer or a woman doctor or a woman dentist. And the wives of policemen complained that they didn't want their husband sitting in a police car 8 hours a day next to a woman policewoman. And legal firms said that they'll lose clients if they have women as lawyers. So that was another issue we dealt with. And the commission ruled that you can't refuse to hire someone who's qualified to do a job because you think your clients or customers won't like it. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on.
Sure. You know, a little bit of a shift here, but I think it's important that people understand that with the accomplishments, it's never easy, and that there are struggles involved. And in reading that chapter of your book that you shared with me, there was a moment you talk about at the end of the day, you ran out of the office with tears streaming down your cheeks. And I think, you know, I want to focus on that because I think a lot of people can relate to that type of a moment in their struggles. And I wanted to ask you, what people and thoughts did you sort of cling to keep yourself motivated to stay in the fight and keep doing the work you were doing?
Well, I'll explain what you mentioned. I had had a talk with the executive director of the EOC at that time. He was a guy named Herman Adelsberg, and he was not a feminist. And I was having a discussion with him. And the reason I left and tears were streaming down my face was that I had absolutely no power in my discussion with him. Mm-hmm. I was just another lawyer in the general counsel's office. He was the executive director. So we were constantly up against men who had power, and we didn't have any. It never occurred to me to give up the fight. Never, I don't ever remember thinking that.
Okay.
But what did occur to me was that we needed to, a couple of things. First of all, I became part of an informal network of women and men who felt as I did. And we communicated with each other, we shared information. I told them about cases that were coming down the pike at the OC. And a woman named Marguerite Raywald then had a cadre of private attorneys in private practice who would represent women in those cases. So we had this informal network. And because we realized that we had to band together and we had to become stronger to make this fight. We couldn't do it on an individual, personal level. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there came a time when Betty Friedan came to my office, and I suggested to her that what this country needed was an organization to fight for women like the NAACP, the National Organization for the Protection of Colored People, fought for its constituency. And others felt similarly, and that led to the founding of NOW. And that was, as I mentioned earlier, in direct response to the fact that we needed to get the EOC to enforce the law for women.
Mm-hmm. And you were also, while that was happening in those conversations, you were also having some secret meetings by night at Mary Eastwood's apartment in Southwest D.C. And
yes.
I loved your description of that and thought, you know, my goodness, were you ever fearful of losing your job when those things were happening? And can you talk a little bit about that?
I was never fearful of losing my job because I think I had, my parents were not well-to-do people, but they were comfortable financially, middle-class people. And they never wanted me to go to college or law school or have a career because they came from a village in Poland. They had no education. And all they knew about was that when a young woman gets to be about 18, she is supposed to marry and stay home and raise a family. So they were not in favor of my getting an education, although they were so phenomenal in that they paid for me to go to college, they paid for me to go to law school. They moved their home from up north to Florida so I could live with them when I went to law school, which they didn't want me to go to, but they paid for it. So I had these phenomenal parents, and after I graduated from law school, I got a job in Washington, D.C., and before I passed the bar, I could only be a law clerk, and I was making $3,500 a year, which is what law clerks were making in those days. And my mother said to me, "What are you going to work for? You can stay home. Daddy will give you $3,500 a year, and you can do whatever you want." So I was never fearful of losing my job because I always knew that my father could support me. That was not a factor. I don't know about other people, but that was never a factor for me. And I did lose a job when I worked for TRW because of my outspokenness. And at that time I really couldn't afford to lose a job because I was divorced and I had a child to support, but that simply was never a factor for me. I wanted to say something else about what happened. I'm trying to remember how these things began, but one of the feminists who was with me all the way was a woman named Mary Eastwood, and she worked in the Justice Department, and she was a founder of NOW, as I was. And we used to get together in her apartment. It was me and Mary and a lawyer named Carruthers Berger, and I think a non-lawyer named Morek Simchek. I'm not sure. It's in my book. And we used to get together at her apartment in southeast or southwest Washington. And I used to share, it used to be four, five, six of us, and I would share with them what I had seen and experienced that week at the EEOC, what issues they were taking, what the commission was doing with regard to women's rights, what it wasn't doing. This is, of course, highly improper. You're not supposed to do that. But I did. And then we would draft letters to the EEOC, to the commission, and say, "How come you're doing this? How come you're doing that? Why aren't you doing this?" And sign it now. And as I say in my book, I thought it was funny that nobody from the EEOC ever said, "How come NOW knows what we're talking about in our meetings?" And nothing ever, nothing negative ever affected any of us at those meetings as a result of those letters.
Too funny. I'm also wondering, for the time that has elapsed up to the present day, if there are things that you can point us to that you feel like are either a direct or an indirect sort of ripple effect of the founding of NOW and the work that it contributed to.
Oh my God! Well, one of the things that I do is I send out articles to a feminist list I have every day. Mostly articles from the New York Times or articles from the Washington Post. Sometimes they're from Facebook. Sometimes they're from a Jewish newspaper that I read online called The Forward. Sometimes they're just my own thoughts. Every day there are developments happening with regard to women. Of course, one of the biggest battles that is still going on is the fight over abortion. But there are unbelievable numbers of issues every day that come up. Today I was reading something I've read at least 1,000 times, that there are not enough women in STEM programs. STEM, it stands for science, technology, engineering, something like that. We don't have enough women going into those programs, getting educated in those programs, getting jobs in those programs. And those are good-paying positions, and there's always an effort on to get more young women into those fields. It's better than it used to be. A recent article I read was about the fact that when a man and a woman, scholars, professors, or researchers, write a paper, let's say it's Miss Jones and Mr. Smith, for example, when people talk about that paper, they only talk about Smith's paper, and they forget that a woman was a co-author of the article.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing in the world, but it's an example of the kinds of issues that are constantly still going on. The most egregious issues have been dealt with, but the nuanced issues, the more subtle issues, and abortion is not a subtle issue,
mm-hmm.
are still very much going on. I always have to laugh. Every once in a while, I'll come across a man who says, women's rights, I thought all those issues have been taken care of. There are plenty of men walking around, and some women undoubtedly also, who think that all the problems have been solved. But, of course, it's far from the truth.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, and because it's, do you think we've taken any steps backwards in the movement, or do you think it's just that there's constantly things bubbling to the surface that we have yet to address, or maybe a little of both?
Whether we've gone backwards, I don't think we've gone backwards. You'd have to give me an example of something. I think we continue to go forward, but as I said, in abortion, that's an area where I think we have gone backwards,
mm-hmm.
because the states are passing all these laws to make it difficult for women to get an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really horrible, because a woman who's financially comfortable will always find a way to have an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, for example, in Berlin, Germany, had 7 abortions.
Wow.
As she was married to my father, but she told me that it wasn't fashionable in Berlin for well-to-do people to have a lot of children. Now, I don't know why that was applicable, because all she had was my brother. But she had 7 abortions, and it was no problem for her. She had 2 abortionists, and no problem for her getting an abortion. And the same is true in the United States. Women with money will always be able to get an abortion. So what these laws do is they discriminate against poor women. They put such burdens on their getting abortions. They pass regulations for doctors who perform abortions. They have to meet certain standards which have nothing to do with women's health. And they put in waiting periods that if a woman wants to have an abortion, she has to first wait for a waiting period. And these are called TRAP laws.
Yes, ma'am.
TRAP, I forget what that stands for.
Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So that is still going on. And I think in some ways we've gone backward. And if the Republicans and this Trump administration has its way, we will continue to go backwards and make it more difficult for women to have abortions. A positive development,
mm-hmm.
But it is unlawful in I don't know how many states, is that there was just a survey that showed you can now have an abortion pretty well on your own or with a friend there by using 2 chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget their exact names. They're in my papers. But you can self-abort using these chemicals, as I said, either alone or you can have a friend with you, and that the safety of these chemicals is good. But a number of states in the United States prohibit that, or else they also put burdens on it. You have to have a doctor there, it has to be such and such, and again, the same kind of burdens that they put on other laws. So this is a difficult area because it's punitive to poor women.
Mm-hmm. you know, and you touched on something else that I want to go back to a little bit when you mentioned your mom and disclosing that she had 7 abortions, and you had even alluded to in some of your writings that, you know, your birth was somewhat fortunate in that she didn't have access to her abortionist at the time, or some, please forgive my memory if it's not quite capturing that right, but I would defer to you to elaborate on that, because you take it to the next level in terms of the steps in your life and you just feeling the sense of purpose as the steps followed through. So I just want to touch on that too.
Well, as I said, my mother had 2 abortions. Oh, and the year before she became pregnant with me, she'd had an ectopic pregnancy. And she told me that it took her a year to recover from it.
Wow.
And she told me that she didn't eat much during that time, and they had servants in Berlin, my parents, and she used to say that she'd walk in the apartment and a maid would be behind her with a cup of tea or something, as she didn't eat much. And she was told that she must never get pregnant again because she was so seriously ill from this ectopic pregnancy. And then she became pregnant with me. So she had these 2 abortionists. And she liked one better than the other one, and she went to him, and he was having an affair with a ballerina.
Ooh.
And had taken her away to the Swiss Alps that time when my mother came to his office. So she came home and was going to go to the other abortionist a day or so later. So she came home and she went to bed. And my father came home and saw her in bed, and he said, oh, you had it done. And she said, no, Dr. So-and-so's in the Swiss Alps. I'll have to go to Dr. So-and-so next. And my father said, let it be already. So under those iffy circumstances, I was born.
And then, you know, another thing that I don't think I've seen a ton of coverage, but I was... you know, also surprised to see you're also a breast cancer survivor, which I think, you know, is also encouraging for other women out there. And can you talk a little bit about your role in women's health in that regard?
Well, I haven't had a particular role in that. In 1990, I had a routine mammogram, which I had the sense to have every year. And after I had the mammogram, I got a call from the x-ray office. They didn't tell me much. They just said pictures didn't come out so good, and they wanted to retake them. So I really didn't think anything of it. And I went and had the mammogram redone. And then I was called in by my surgeon, and I was told that I had breast cancer, and I've written an article about this. It's not in, I don't think it's in my memoirs, it's a freestanding article. And I felt as if somebody had thrown a basin of water, cold water, in my face. I was absolutely stunned. It never occurred to me that I would get cancer, breast cancer, or anything like that. So then I had Then there was the question of whether I needed a mastectomy or could have a lumpectomy with radiation. And this was in 1990. And in addition to having a very small breast cancer, I also had something called carcinoma in situ, which are cells that could develop into cancer or they could not. And there was no way of knowing. And at that time, they did not know whether lumpectomy and radiation got rid of carcinoma in situ. They knew that it got rid of cancer, but they didn't know whether it got rid of this. So my doctor advised me to have a mastectomy, which I did. I had a mastectomy and a simultaneous silicone breast implant. The following year, my surgeon told me that now we know that a lumpectomy and radiation is as effective with carcinoma in situ as it is with regular cancer. But the information came a year too late for me, and I lost my breast. So that was in 1990. Then in, I think it was in 2005, and I may be wrong on my years, I was in Florida for the winter, and I would look at myself in the mirror, and it seemed to me that the breast implant looked smaller to me than my other breast. And I kept looking at it, and it looked too small to me. So then I went back to Washington, D.C., where I live full-time, and I tried to talk to my surgeon and ask him about it, and he could never reach him. But I did reach the plastic surgeon who had put in the implant, and he said, I never heard of such a thing, and don't worry about it. And then I went to the oncologist, and I asked him about it. And he said, I never heard of such a thing. I'm sure it's fine. Don't worry about it. Well, then it just so happened there was an organization in Washington. I can't think of the name of it now because it changed names. But the head of it is a woman named Diana Zuckerman. And it's an organization for women's health. Mm-hmm. And they were starting at that time. They still have it now. They were starting to recognize the same thing that your Now chapter is doing. They were starting to recognize women as foremothers. Mm-hmm. And I was in the first group of women recognized as foremothers, and they were having a luncheon. So I went to that luncheon, and I was sitting at a table with about five or six women. And about half of the women at that table had had breast cancer.
Wow.
And I was surprised at that, and we started to talk about it. I mentioned that I had this thought that my breast implant had gotten smaller, but that all the doctors of mine that I'd spoken to told me to forget about it. And then one of the women said to me, don't you know that Diana Zuckerman, who was then and is today the director of this women's health group, don't you know that she's an expert on breast cancer? I said, I didn't know that. So I went home from that luncheon, and I sent a letter to Diana. And I told her I had this concern about my breast implant. And she wrote me back and said that there's a doctor named George Middleton. He was in California. And he's written a book about breast cancer, and he's an expert on this kind of thing. And that I should write to him and ask him my question. So I wrote to him, and he wrote me back immediately. And he said that I need to have a special kind of mammogram. By the way, when I'd asked my plastic surgeon whether I should have a mammogram, he was recommending that I have a mammogram. And Diana Zuckerman, when I asked her about that, said to me, absolutely not, because if your implant did rupture or is leaking, a mammogram could make it worse. But George Middleton said to me that I needed to have a special kind of mammogram which had certain features, and he spelled them out for me, mm-hmm. which would tell whether my implant had ruptured or was leaking. And that I should call around in Washington, D.C., where I lived, to find a laboratory that had the facilities for that special kind of mammogram. And, he said, after the laboratory where I had it read gave me the results, I should send the mammogram pictures to him, and he would read it also. So I made those calls. I found a lab that did those special kind of mammograms. And they reported to me that my implant had ruptured and was leaking. And then I sent that mammogram to George Middleton, and he confirmed it. So then I asked Diana Zuckerman where to go to have my implant removed and replaced. And she sent me to a doctor. I went to Cleveland, Ohio. She said the top doctor for this kind of thing is this particular doctor that she sent me to. And I went to Cleveland, and she removed the implant, which was not an easy thing to do because it had leaked and it was going through my body. and she removed that and replaced it with a saline implant. Mm-hmm. So those are my experiences with breast cancer so far.
And today, knock on wood, all things have been healthy?
As far as I know.
Great. And then I think, I know we're kind of wrapping up towards the end of the hour. I did want to pick your brain about, and I know there are so many directions we could go in terms of forward progress, but if I were to task you with helping to sort of focus us and prioritize sort of next steps in the movement for things in terms of how we should be focusing our energies for women's rights, how would you recommend we do that in terms of top priorities?
Well, abortion is a top priority.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I don't know. I would just have to take a look at some of my papers and some of my writing. There are many areas where women are not treated equally today. Entertainment industry is one that comes to mind where we don't have enough. And I'm talking the movies and theater, all aspects of the entertainment industry, as directors, as writers, as producers. Women are not being equally represented. Gina Davis, the actress, has formed an organization that deals with the representation of women in the media. That's a field. The justice field is a field where women are not equally distributed in all jobs, prosecutors, all kinds of positions, people in the police department. You could take just about any field, mm-hmm. and we still have to work for women to get equality, and we still have to work for women to get equal pay.
Absolutely.
Right now, women earn about 80 cents on the dollar to what men earn, which is a big improvement from what it used to be. It used to be like 58 cents, but we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember where you were when President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act? Do you remember what you were doing when that happened?
No.
No.
Of course, I'm very familiar with that act.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea where I was at the time.
Okay. And sort of lastly, if people want to learn more about you, Sonia, and you know, your speaking engagements and or, you know, your website, do you want to put any plugs for how they could learn more about the work that you've done or any maybe future engagements on the horizon that we could mention now?
All right. I appreciate your asking that question. Well, first, they may want to, not necessarily first, but one of the things they may want to do is read my memoir. It's called Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter. And they can get that from Amazon.com. It's available in hard copy, soft copy, and for Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have a website, and it's erraticimpact.com/Fuentes, my last name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a huge amount of information and material on that website. It's got articles I've written, photographs, my connection with the Red Star Line Museum in Antwerp, Belgium, which has a permanent exhibit about me. It's about awards that I've gotten. It's got about six or eight categories, and it's just chock full of information. I recently decided, I've been giving speeches about women's rights and writing articles about it for 50 years, and I decided that I am going to stop giving those kinds of major speeches. They usually ran 30, 45 minutes, an hour. And I'm not going to give those kinds of speeches anymore. What I'm doing now is that I give short talks of about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I open the floor up to a Q&A. And I talk about a number of subjects, but the main ones are either I talk about my life or I talk about the women's rights movement. And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they could email me. My email is S as in Sam, P as in Peter, F as in Frank, U, E, N for Nancy, T for Tom, E, S for Sam, at Comcast.net. And I'd be happy to arrange to give that kind of a talk to any organization they may have.
Wonderful. Well, Sonia, thank you so much for taking the time with me today. I look forward to getting this archived with the Virginia Now folks. Any other final thoughts before we part ways?
No, it's been a pleasure talking with you, particularly since I was one of the 49 founders of Now, and you are with a chapter of Now. Yes. So that's particularly meaningful to me.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to being in touch after the fact.
Thanks, and you're going to be kind enough to send my webmaster a copy of this audio, am I right?
Correct. Yes, ma'am.
Give my best regards to your colleagues in the chapter.
I will most certainly do that.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure emailing you.
Likewise. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.